This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio. Mino Studio is a pre- and post-production facility for all of your audio needs. Mino Studio's founder is an accredited audio engineer with top 40 and indie album credits. With over 30 years of music industry experience, Mino Studio can take your podcast from idea to reality. Contact Mino Studio at MinoStudio777@gmail.com for more information. That's Mino Studio spelled M-E-N-O, MinoStudio777@gmail.com.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, today we have a great show planned for you. We know a lot of you folks that have been writing in and calling and speaking to me are concerned about how to set up your real estate investing endeavors. And there are a number of things involved in that aspect. And we have somebody here today that is involved with the legal side of setting up a real estate investing. Our guest is Clint Coons, and he is a founding partner and manager of Anderson Business Advisors and Law Group, the nation's premier provider of asset protection and tax planning services for real estate investors. Clint has taken what he has learned through his own investing and coupled it with his experiences representing some of the country's best real estate investors, and provides this knowledge to anyone interested in learning how to properly structure their real estate investments. So I am real thrilled to have you here, Clint. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, this is an area, you know, some people, and I tend to be one of those people, you know, sometimes when we start getting into some of the legalese of the things that we sort of have to do when we're involved in real estate investing, eyes just glaze over. And so I'm glad to have you on because I know that you're one who can take a lot of those legal aspects of what we do and make it more simple to digest, so to speak. So, but what I'd like you to do, if you could, I just sort of gave a brief overview of your background, be real interested in hearing more, and especially some aspects of how your investing has influenced what you do as well.
Yeah, you know, really my influence started when I was probably 4 years old. And the reason I say that is because my father was an avid real estate investor, and I always use the qualification was because he stopped investing when I graduated from law school because he no longer had an indentured servant to work on his real estate for him. So I grew up with this experience and going out there, working on properties, you know, multifamilies. I mean, we used to actually buy homes for a dollar, people that were going to tear them down, and we would lift them up and move them and put them onto a new foundation and then hook the house back up. And you'd have, you know, a lot of instant equity right there by making that move. And so I gained this knowledge of real estate through watching my father and his success in buying properties and then rehabbing them. And so when I was in undergrad, I actually contemplated a life as a contractor. And in fact, I was a framer for a couple of years while I was going to college. And then I took a year off and also worked as a framer. And I thought my life was going to take that path, but there was a slowdown in the economy. And, you know, I live in Washington State, and I often ask people, you know, what does it do in Washington State in October, November, January, February? I mean, we could just keep going. It rains. And I'm out there on a roof, pouring down rain, fixing some bird blocks somebody else couldn't do with this pickup work I was taking on. And I said, you know, I slipped and I didn't fall, but it was a wake-up call. I said, I really can't see myself doing this for the rest of my life. And so then I followed the path of my grandfather. He is an attorney or was an attorney. He's passed away. And I decided to go to law school. And I went to law school and I graduated law school in 3 years. And then I embarked on my own. I started Anderson Business Advisors with my partner, Toby Mathis. And our focus has always been asset protection. And so I took what I'd learned in real estate investing, as far as I saw the troubles that people faced when they owned real estate, namely my father, who had zero asset protection. And it's really troubling because my grandfather was an attorney, my father's father, and he never once sat down with my dad and said, you should really structure yourself. You know, not only you have to be concerned about those tenants, but, you know, look at your two sons. I mean, they bring liability to you as well. You could lose everything you have just based upon some of those crazy things that they do. And so this was never communicated to him. He never understood it. I mean, you mentioned, you know, something about taking something that's complicated and making it appear simple. Well, I find most attorneys take something that's simple and intentionally make it appear complicated. And they do this to, you know, maintain control of the client, maintain control of the conversation, and or, you know, to hide sometimes their own lack of knowledge, because they always want to be in control. And that's something my grandfather expressed to me about my practice of law, because when I first started out, one of the guiding principles for myself and the firm is that we want to ensure that our clients understand all aspects of what we're doing for them. We want to put them in a position where essentially, if they don't want us, they don't need us, because they're going to figure this stuff out along the way. We're going to teach them how an LLC works, how to create one if they want it. So then they can go out there and do it on their own. And this runs contrary to the way a lot of attorneys practice. And so this is what I took to the practice of law initially when we started Anderson. And we coupled that with my knowledge of investing and working with various real estate investors that I grew up with. And I saw the problems that they faced because they lacked asset protection. And I used my father as the example. I mean, he was involved in a few lawsuits that I can recall. And because he didn't have any protection, his modus operandi was settle. And that's what my grandfather would tell him, just pay to make the claim go away. Now, in some instances, that is good advice. However, you know, it depends on the nature of the claim. And I've worked now, you know, 19 years of practicing. I've been involved with some clients who have been in some very hairy situations where we're talking $15, $20 million potential judgments that could be levied against them. And unfortunately, so many of these cases, you know, they're not worth the paper they're written on. But our society has deviated from the core principle that is, you used to have to do something wrong in order to be sued. And that's no longer the case. And when you have a strong asset protection plan in place that encompasses not only, you know, using the appropriate entities for your type of investing, but also using, you know, different types of shields, such as an anonymity shield, so no one knows that you even own the assets, you can oftentimes walk away from these cases without any actual liability, because the other side realizes that you're not going to get any blood from a turnip, that there's nothing there, because they can't discover it. And so that is what has been my driving force going forwards. Once I started Anderson, I wanted to put people in that position where they could defend themselves without fear of loss. And Anderson, we've been very successful at doing this. When we started off within a year, Toby and I had 40 people working for us. And now we've grown the firm to over 80 employees. And we've incorporated not only the legal side, but we've also brought in the tax side, because so many real estate investors, they receive advice that I like to refer to as accurate advice. They go to their attorney and the attorney says, you know, based on the type of investing you're engaging in, you should set up an LLC, for instance. And then they'll tell them, well, go talk to your CPA and discuss taxes with him. So then you go to your CPA, who may not know your attorney, and now you have two professionals advising you, and they're not working together in a collaborative effort to make sure that your plan is relevant to you. I mean, both could be giving you accurate advice, and so you follow their advice because you fact check it and you find that it's accurate, but it's not relevant to what you're doing. And as a personal real estate investor who owns property in over 7 different states, and I own both residential, commercial property, I've rehabbed and flipped property for several years, you know, I understand the issues that investors face when it comes to creating a structure, because you have to look beyond just asset protection as well. You don't want to put yourself in a situation where now I've locked you up so tight that you couldn't apply for a loan because no underwriter is going to underwrite that loan when they look at your tax returns. So you want to make sure that your plan is relevant and is flexible enough to allow you to continue to grow your business. And so that's what I've always focused on. And, you know, things change, laws change, the market changes. And if you're not in it and currently investing and working with investors all over the country, then you're going to run up against these issues when you're trying to advise people. And that is, you're giving them information that doesn't necessarily comport with today's challenges.
Wow. That's great. I love that combination of the two, the legal and the accounting side, because you really want to make sure that what you're doing is going to work on both ends. And not only are you going to be protected, but at the same time, your tax liabilities are going to be reduced, hopefully, as well. What I thought we might explore here is just, you know, just looking at some of the basics. When somebody buys a property, you're generally dealing with the legal side because you're going to be signing escrow documents. So that's sort of our first contact with the legal part of it, making sure that even in the offer stage, you want to make sure that you're not committing to anything beyond the due diligence side of things. And so our first stage of legal aspects and when we're purchasing something. For example, if you know we're buying a property, we already know we're in closing stage at this point. Now, would somebody set up the LLC before they purchase the property, or would that be something, you know, directly afterwards, in the midst of closing? When would I'm mentioning an LLC, just assuming again that would be something that'd be associated with the property. Maybe you can clarify on that as well.
Well, not to sound like a traditional attorney, but it depends. it really does. You know, the initial question you always face when it comes to buying real estate is, are you going to take this property down for cash or are you going to finance it? And if you're financing and you're usually traditional sources, so we don't have private money here or hard money that's coming in to secure this deal, then you're going to be at the behest of the bank that you're working with. And most lenders are not going to permit you to take title in an entity. They're going to require that you take title in your own name because, if it's a residential property, and that's my assumption here we're talking about, then they're going to write that up as a residential mortgage, not a commercial mortgage. So it requires that you go on title in order to obtain that loan. Now, there are community banks that are willing to allow individual investors to take title in an LLC because they plan to treat the loan as a portfolio loan. So they're not as concerned with trying to, you know, they're not going to sell it. So they don't need someone to come in and buy it. And they want the loan to look really good to a potential purchaser of that pool. So oftentimes the way I set it up is as follows. If you want to buy for cash, then I would start at the outset with a structure that's going to provide you protection. And I would create the LLC before you buy, and I would make my offer in the name of that limited liability company. Now, I've heard attorneys tell me and real estate investors that they'll wait until their money goes hard before they set up an LLC to take title to the property. And that's fine. You can do that as well. But I prefer to write the offer in the name of the LLC rather than wait until the money goes hard and then plan to close in the LLC. Because when you write an offer and you sign a purchase and sale agreement, when you do that in your own name, now you're on the hook personally for whatever's in that agreement. And there's a 6-year statute of limitations with any contract that you sign. This is pretty much uniform across all 50 states. So I'm a firm believer in limiting your overall liability exposure at the very outset rather than waiting. And the best example of this is a client of mine that I recently took on. And the way it's set up is that she put in an offer on 6 properties. And she's working with the seller to buy these 6 properties. And she had to bring in gap funding because she didn't have enough money. And here we are, less than a week away from closing. And she contacted her gap funder about the $70,000 that she needed to close. And the gap funder, unfortunately, didn't have it because another project that he had anticipated having his money back from had not come back yet. They'd run into delays over there. So he told her, he said, "I cannot get you that money prior to closing. I'm real sorry about that." So she went back to the seller and tried to renegotiate or, you know, extend the closing by another 3 weeks. And the seller just flatly refused. And the seller told her that she better be there next week to close, because if she isn't, he's going to sue her personally because she entered into that agreement in her personal name. And the seller did have substantial damages because those 6 properties were short sales and the bank had given him a drop dead date of the date of their closing, that if he didn't close on that date, then the deal was off the table, his short sale that he negotiated with the bank for these 6 homes. So he had substantial damages that were going to be imposed if she couldn't close. And so that, you know, she became my client after the fact, after this big mess for her. It cost her a fair amount of money to deal with. And so that could have been simplified or rectified at the outset had she taken title or entered into that purchase and sale agreement, that is, in the name of an LLC or corporation, depends on what you plan to do with the properties. And then if you can't get your funding, yes, you lose your earnest money, but it gives you flexibility where you can walk away without facing personal liability to the seller. So I think you should set it up ahead of time before you even put the offer in. And I've seen numerous real estate investors who have not heeded that advice because their local attorney has given him accurate information that, yes, you can close in the name of the LLC. But again, it's not relevant because they have not been exposed to the number of clients that I've worked with, since we have so many clients across the country that have been sued over the purchase and sale agreement personally because their name went on there. So I like to start it with the LLC.
That's great. Now, maybe I should have taken a step backward just to explain to people what exactly is an LLC.
So an LLC is a business entity that's formed under a particular state. So it's a limited liability company. A lot of people sometimes get this mixed up and they call it a corporation. And there is no such thing as a limited liability corporation. But an LLC is designed to limit your risk exposure. So it's like a corporation from the standpoint that if you take title or you enter into an agreement in the name of the company, you're not doing so on behalf of yourself. You're doing so on behalf of this organization. So the person who accepts that agreement or signs that contract, they understand that should there be a default in the agreement, that their claim runs to the company itself and not to the individual owners. And so it provides a liability shield. One benefit of the LLC often referred to is, I call it, what happens in the box stays in the box. So you think of the LLC as a box. And if any liability is generated from inside of that box, say you own a rental property and the tenant decides to sue, then that LLC is going to contain that infection. And it's going to hold it in there until it's settled or until the thing actually has to collapse in on itself. And it's going to keep it away from you and your other assets. So that's what makes an LLC so attractive to real estate investors, is that it protects you from the liabilities associated with owning a dangerous asset such as real estate. But on the flip side, if you know how to set up your LLC and you know where to set up your LLC or how to hold your LLC that is in the appropriate jurisdiction, then it also protects your assets from your liabilities. So again, we take that box analogy. And rather than what happens inside the box, we say what happens outside the box stays on the outside of the box. a common misconception that people don't realize is that if you set up a corporation, for instance, and a judgment's rendered against you personally, a creditor could take the shares in your corporation. Now, the same is not true of a limited liability company that is set up in a state that only offers what we refer to as charging order protections. So that if you got sued and a judgment's entered against you, then they can't take your LLC from you. They become essentially a lien holder if they choose to proceed with a charging order remedy. And in my experience, that just does not happen. The only time I have seen lawsuits against members or owners of LLCs that have gone on to take the LLC from the individual owner is in those instances when people have set up their LLC and they own it in the wrong jurisdiction that allows a creditor to take their interest. So knowing how these things go together is so really very important to creating an overall complete asset protection structure.
Let's say I'm in California. I have a California LLC for my company here, but I'm buying the property in Cleveland. Could I use my California LLC, or should I get the LLC in Cleveland, in Ohio?
Yeah. Well, my rule of thumb is always you're going to create the LLC in the state where the property is located because you're essentially doing business there. And recently I sat down with someone who went to a real estate investor seminar, and through that seminar they signed up for an LLC through a company out of Nevada, essentially an entity mill. And they set them up with a Nevada limited liability company. Now, keep in mind, I mean, we have several offices in Las Vegas, and we do set up a number of Nevada LLCs and Wyoming LLCs. But again, it has to be relevant. And the individual that recommended they create a Nevada LLC for their Illinois property, they gave them all the benefits of Nevada and how it provides asset protection. 100% accurate information they received. But it's not relevant when you own property in Illinois, because when you buy property in Illinois and you hold it in your Nevada LLC, everything works out just fine until that first lawsuit develops, or more importantly, when you own rental real estate, when that first tenant quits paying you, and then you have to bring an unlawful detainer action against them to kick them out. Well, this individual tried to bring an unlawful detainer action, and they found out that because they were not registered in the state of Illinois, that it was a Nevada LLC, not registered to do business in Illinois, they could not evict their tenant. So now they had to go through this entire process of taking that entity and now registering in Illinois, paying two state filing fees. And so had I met with them initially, I would have told them, set up the LLC in Illinois because that's where your property is located. However, you brought up California. When you're dealing with a state such as California or another weak, what we refer to as charging order states, I'm not going to recommend that you hold that LLC in your own name. That is, you're not going to be the member of that LLC. What I will do is create a holding LLC in either Nevada or Wyoming, kind of like a shield. Just think of it as a large box. You're going to create this huge box in Wyoming because Wyoming provides excellent charging order protection. So if somebody sues you individually, they cannot take your interest from you. And then into that large box, you're going to place all of your smaller boxes that are filed around the country and hold your various properties. So your Illinois LLC would be placed in there, your California, your Ohio, all those LLCs get placed into this one large box. And so that stands as a blocker between your creditors and all of your assets. And if you do it right, you can set it up so that no one even knows that you're associated with those in-state LLCs, because Wyoming and Nevada offer you the ability to create entities that provide an anonymity shield. So there's a lot that goes into planning. And many times when I sit down with individuals and they find out, you know, they compare what I'm teaching them versus the way they were structured, they want to go back and fix it. And unfortunately, that, you know, once you've created it, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no putting it back in. We can't go back and obtain anonymity for you. Something has to be done at the outset.
Oh, that's great. Great information. Let's say, for example, using that same Cleveland property that I buy, and I've purchased a multifamily. Let's say it's like a 10-unit apartment. And one of the tenants there, it's raining. They slip on the stairs, cement stairs going up to the property because they hurt themselves. They're feeling, well, there should have been a rougher type of cement there or concrete. So I'm going to sue the owner of this building. Now, my LLC is in Ohio, but let's say that, you know, they look at the building. Oh, they're trying to figure out a value on it. They're thinking it's not, doesn't have that much. I'm going to go after the owner. Now, I mean, can they go beyond the building in terms of assets in a lawsuit to try and collect on their, whatever they're suing you for?
Well, so in that particular fact pattern, what would typically occur is you're going to bring an action against the limited liability company that owns the property. So it's the responsible party. And you're going to allege your set of facts. And hopefully, you know, if you're the plaintiff's attorney, you're going to try to shake them down and get the insurance to pay out. And if you go beyond policy limits, then yes, all of the assets of the LLC will be at risk and subject to attachment to that creditor. So this is a key component of a good asset protection plan, and that is do not own more than one property per limited liability company. Because again, if you think of it from the box analogy, if you have all your eggs in that one box, if one goes bad, they could all go bad. So we don't want to put all of our eggs or apples, probably even a better analogy, into one box. You want to keep them in separate boxes. So yes, you know, you can have something go bad. I mean, I just think about it. Just this weekend, we had a dinner party, and I went into our vegetable drawer, and I pulled it open, and one vegetable had started to already deteriorate. It was in the very back, but anything touching it, it also started to deteriorate as well. And if you think about that vegetable drawer as an LLC, you know, over time, that could have infected the entire drawer by having that one bad vegetable in there that starts the bacteria growth, and then it spreads to everything else. Whereas if you took it, you put it in its own separate drawer in your refrigerator, yes, it's going to go bad, but it's only going to be that one that's going bad. The other vegetables remain fresh and safe in their separate boxes. And so that's how I approach asset protection planning.
So if I'm an investor in Ohio, again, using that example, so I've got this 10-unit, I've got an LLC for it, but I want to buy some other properties there. You're recommending that each of those properties should have their own LLC also in Ohio?
Yes, that's correct. I would create one LLC per property, and then I would have all of those LLCs held by a Wyoming LLC. Now, this serves two purposes. Number one, it gives you a blocker entity via that Wyoming LLC to keep all your Ohio LLCs protected from any personal creditors you may have. Number two, it ensures that all of those Ohio LLCs can be disregarded limited liability companies. Now, this is from a tax standpoint. If I sit down with someone and they tell me I have 10 LLCs, my initial question is, how many tax returns are you filing? And if they tell me they're filing 10 tax returns, then 9 times out of 10, I know who set up their structure, a CPA, because that's how CPAs get paid, right? On the number of tax returns they have to file on an annual basis. And I'm dead on that. And people start laughing. In reality, is you could create those LLCs and have them ignored for federal tax purposes, so you don't have to file a single tax return for any of them. And so creating that type of structure, you want to make sure that you're minimizing your ongoing costs. You don't want to create something that's going to take, you know, $7,000 or $10,000 a year just to maintain it in legal and accounting fees. And so creating a structure is also about looking at what is the impact on the individual on an ongoing basis.
Well, you hit on really a key point there too. And I think comes to mind for a lot of folks that are listening is, okay, well, wow, this is sounding involved and maybe even complicated. When you talk about the cost, there is a cost to set one up, and then there's also a fee for that state on an annual basis. Is that correct? And roughly, I know this is tough to say because it depends on the situation, but just ballpark, what's involved in setting one up and maintaining it on a regular basis?
Setting them up, you're going to have the upfront costs for the attorney to draft your LLC, and that can range anywhere from, you know, $1,500 to $6,000, $10,000, depending on the firm that you use. And then on top of that, you're going to have the ongoing costs of keeping it compliant with the state, and that's going to depend on the state. You said California, for instance, they charge $800 a year in a franchise fee to have an LLC plus the state registration fee. So in California, it's going to run you about $1,000 a year to maintain it. I talked about Wyoming. That's going to run you $150 a year to maintain it. So then you'd also, you look at the states as well. For example, I'm working with a client. I gave him a proposal yesterday. He has 20-some properties in Massachusetts. And ideally, you might want to create a bunch of Massachusetts LLCs to separate out all these multifamilies. But the problem is Massachusetts charges $700 a year to renew an LLC. And then you put the resident agent fee on top of it, you're about, you know, $800 per LLC. And when we, you know, when he did the math, he said, Clint, I'm not going to spend, $16,000 a year to maintain a structure. And I completely understand it. I would never recommend that he do that. So that's when you have to get creative and you have to really think outside of the box. And that is, you know, how do we create a structure that will keep our cost minimized, but also provide us asset protection? And so then you look to the use of entities that do not require a filing in the state, but are title holding entities, and then have that interest held by an out-of-state LLC, such as Wyoming, where it's $50 a year. And so you get around the problem of the Illinois example I gave you by having an out-of-state entity holding in-state property. You give yourself asset protection and you minimize your ongoing costs. So it's a matter of, you know, understanding how entities work and dealing with real estate investors and creating an overall plan that addresses all facets of what they're trying to do.
Gotcha. So in a place like Massachusetts and somebody that is buying multiple properties there, what would you recommend as far as a structure to try and reduce costs?
Well, what I'm typically going to recommend is that you have a management company there. So I would set up a corporation or an LLC as an overall property management entity. And the nice thing about Massachusetts is you don't have to be a licensed real estate agent or broker to manage real estate. And on top of that, then I would take each property and I would put it inside of a land trust. And then I would assign the land trust to a Wyoming limited liability company. And then all of those Wyoming LLCs would be held by one blocker Wyoming LLC, what we call a holding company. So in this particular structure that, you know, I brought up, he has one Massachusetts entity, and that is his management company, because it is the one that will deal with all of the tenants for those multiple units. And so the Massachusetts entity will collect all of the rents, deal with the tenants, handle their issues for the various properties. But then all the money is going to run back to the Wyoming out-of-state LLCs that own the land trust interests that own the properties in Massachusetts.
I see. So each deed would have a different land trust on it?
That's correct. Each deed would have its own separate land trust, and each land trust would have its own separate LLC, which is the beneficiary. And if you desire anonymity, as this client does, we're setting it up where we're using a nominee trustee. So, I will be on all of his land trusts from a title holding standpoint, from a public records point of view, just for filing purposes. I have no control over the real estate. It's there just to protect my client's ownership in these properties, and I resign my position once it's been filed. My client takes over, but no one knows that. And that type of protection cannot be understated. I recently dealt with a client in LA that was involved in a very bad lawsuit where we're talking $20 million in requested damages from the plaintiff for some injuries on outside of a nightclub that he owns. And I had structured him similarly, where we had land trusts and LLCs, and this is all in California, and he ended up walking away just for policy limits. But the person that owned the building where the nightclub was housed, that individual could not walk away with policy limits because that individual had all of his real estate in his own name. And what the plaintiff's attorney said when he tried to settle as well for policy limits, they said, you know, we performed an asset search on you, and in LA County alone, you're worth a minimum of $25 million. And that's true. It's actually worth more than that, but that's what they found just in LA County. And so they refused to settle. But what they didn't know, my client is worth at least $25 million in LA County. But all of his properties were held in actually my name as trustee. So it masked the fact that he was involved with these properties. So they just thought he ran a nightclub and he didn't have any assets. And so you can see how anonymity throws off the other side when it comes to negotiating a settlement, because they assume that you don't own anything. And that's key to an asset protection strategy. Control everything, but appear to own nothing.
Okay, so the land trust, it's more helps on the amenity side as opposed to the protection side. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's no asset protection except in the state of Florida with the land trust. So what it's going to give you, it's a title holding vehicle. It basically takes your real property, converts it to personal property, so you can then move that trust into an LLC. So at the end of the day, if somebody does sue the trust, they're going to end up with the LLC that owns the trust. That's why you don't want to own the trust. You have to put it over in your limited liability company. Gotcha. But that's so far down the road, it just doesn't happen.
And the costs associated with having a land trust, roughly would those fall into?
Zero annual maintenance on a land trust. No wow. cost.
Yeah. Wow, that's fantastic. That's great. Well, great. Well, boy, you've provided so much information. Our time just like zip by here, and I'm going, wow. I had like 50 more questions for you, but maybe I can talk you into coming back, and we can follow up on this. But I think as far as our primer and giving people just a basic foundation, I think there was a lot of great information there. How would people reach you?
Well, you can go to AndersonAdvisors.com, and from there you can request a free consultation. So that would be one way to do it. If you wanted to learn more about what we've been discussing, I mean, because as you've recognized, there's a lot to this, check out my YouTube channel. Just type in Clint Coons and YouTube, and you'll see I've posted over 80 videos on different aspects of real estate investing and how to use entities, corporations, LLCs, investing through your IRA or qualified retirement plans, just name a few. So, you know, we believe strongly in educating our people we work with before they become clients, because that gives them a firm base of knowledge and information as to what we're doing for them. And so it becomes more of a collaborative effort.
That's fantastic. Do you also have a book out too, don't you?
Yeah, I do. It's called Asset Protection for Real Estate Investors. Somebody told me the title gives away what the book's about, but
yeah, not really a mystery title here.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's on Amazon.
Yeah, and I might let all of our listeners know too, before you try to write this down while you're driving or jogging or what have you, all of this information, and as well as links to his website and his YouTube channel, will be in our show notes. So you'll just have to go to olddogsreinetwork.com and go to our blog section and look up the show. You should be able to get all these links and information on how to reach Clint as well. And also, we'll have the book link as well in there. Well, that's good information, Clint. I appreciate it so much. I think that this is one of those areas that a lot of us is like, oh, man, you know, I don't want to have to do this. But I myself have a number of LLCs. They all go through a Wyoming LLC. And once it's set up, there's a peace of mind that is there that you just can't monetize. It is just really important to know that if things do happen, that you do have the right structure, and you can go ahead and do what you love doing in terms of real estate investing. And it's just one of those factors you got to put in place to really make sure you're covered, just like buying insurance. This is a close of our show here, Clint, and as all of our guests know and sometimes agonize about, but is that we usually close with an old hound dog howl here. So if you would be so kind to, you know, ingratiate us with your best howl, we'll go ahead as we get ready to close out.
Okay. I've been working on this now for 2 months, just by the way. All right.
Oh, wow. That was good. I felt like I was, it was like one of those Disney dogs, 101 down 8 Dalmatians or something.
Hey, I was a Husky, so I learned something from going to UW.
You never did a you know, voiceover work or anything, huh? That's great. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Clint, for joining us. I want to thank all of our old dog listeners out there for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate that. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king, and real estate investing the means. So until next time, keep moving forward, and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network.
We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.